Welcome to the Meb Faber Show, where the focus is on helping you grow and preserve your wealth. Join us as we discuss the craft of investing and uncover new and profitable ideas, all to help you grow wealthier and wiser. Better investing starts here.
Meb Faber is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Cambria's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Cambria Investment Management or its affiliates. For more information, visit CambriaInvestments.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners. Today, we have a great show for you, all you quant lovers. Our guest is the head of conservative equities and quant allocation at Robeco. You've read his writings in the journal Banking and Finance Management Science and the journal Portfolio Management. I think he's written like 25 white papers on SSRN. He's also a guest lecturer, and we're really happy he's joining us today. Welcome, Pin Van Vliet.
Hi, Matt. Happy to be in your show. Folks in quant stuff.
Yeah, well, we can talk about anything. We can talk about surfing. We can talk about quant. We can talk about anything else. But let's dive right in. All right, so we got a quote Jeff found that you've written that says, "The low volatility effect is perhaps the largest anomaly in finance, challenging the basic trade-off between risk and return, as higher risk does not lead to higher returns. Still, it remains one of the least utilized factor premiums in financial markets." So why don't you unpack this quote for us a bit? Maybe explain low vol anomaly and your thoughts on low vol in general as a good starting point.
That's great. Let's do it. So low volatility is, I think, the biggest anomaly of them all, in the sense of that we really don't understand why this is the case, and also academics and practitioners having troubles embracing this concept. So when I started my studies, like any finance student, I learned about the positive trade-off between risk and return. And a higher risk should lead to a higher return. But it's empirically not the case. So Fama French, 92, showed it, but also earlier on in the 70s, this was documented. So if you knew where to look, you were looking at it. The thing is, in academics, that's the first point I want to make, is that returns are usually measured as simple returns. So that means that all academic studies using simple returns underestimate the size of this anomaly. So high-risk stocks look like they have a pretty low return, but if you add the compounding, then it's really, really bad. So if you read through the literature, like Black, Jensen, Scholes in the 70s, but also Fama French 92, then you should know that this is understating the size of the anomaly, namely that high-risk stocks underperform. And if you compound it out, because high-risk stocks, by definition, go up and down a lot. So if you go down minus 50, go up 50 again, and all investors know that you lost money. But in academia, then you assume that the return is zero. So any high volatility strategy, the return of that is overestimated in academia. So that's a very important point to make. And it's not a mistake of the CAPM or the asset pricing model, but it's the mistake or it's the false assumption of the researchers using the CAPM to test it. Even today, with all the multiple factor extensions, the size of the low-risk anomaly is understated because of this compounding. Because CAPM is a one-period model, and this one period is often assumed to be 1 month, while in reality this is like 1 year or maybe 10 years. And if you add to that, then you will see that the return goes down with volatility. So if you short on volatility or risk or beta or any risk metric, then you will underestimate the alpha.
Could you explain for our listeners who might not be familiar with CAPM exactly what that is? And it's kind of crazy because you have so many of these ideas in academia that get taught that are not, in some cases, not only not true, but 180 degrees not true. Like that, it's true, but the sign is backwards. Maybe explain a little bit what CAPM is and why it's still accepted today if some of the tenets are not accurate.
Yeah, CAPM is a great theory, and when I teach, I also use it, and I also believe that it's a good theory. It's just very bad at describing reality. In fact, a stock with a high risk should have a high return, and that's written down in the CAPM. Only systematic risk should be priced. That's extension of the Markowitz model. Markowitz states that we should diversify, so you get rid of your idiosyncratic company risk, and the only true risk which is priced is market risk. Stocks which have a high beta or a high sensitivity to market fluctuations should have a higher return. And also, CAPM can be used in a corporate finance setting where you make investment decisions in projects. Then you should allocate your capital to low-risk projects which have high returns. But it's a normative framework, but as a theory trying to predict to describe markets, it's really poor, because reality is that high-risk stocks earn low returns. And it's very funny, Matt, when I found out on this, so it was worked by Robert Hogan. I read it as an undergrad student. I was really shocked that low-risk stocks have high returns and high-risk have low returns. And by the way, he was basically really attacking this capital asset pricing model, where he showed this model might be a great theoretical model, but it's really, really poor in predicting and describing markets. So that's the CAPM. This is the theory, and I like it, but it's just not, and I also base my own investments on it. Let's use it as a tool, but it's a very bad description of reality.
You mentioned an early writer on this topic that doesn't get enough credit or sort of headlines. He passed away a few years ago, but he wrote a handful of incredibly influential books. If I remember, The New Finance, The Inefficient Stock Market, and a couple ideas on, we'll post these in the show notes, but fantastic reads on this topic that were really early in some of the ideas you're talking about. And so you had written, maybe to unpack this a little more, you had written about a decade ago, God, 2007, decade ago, you wrote a paper called The Volatility Effect. And maybe walk us through some of like this concept of a simple alternative approach to constructing portfolios, and maybe kind of some of the original ideas of that paper and takeaways.
Back in 2007, we wrote this paper, The Volatility Effect, where we basically laid out that low volatility is a factor besides factors such as size, value, and momentum. In this paper, we take an international perspective. So first, most studies are US-centric. And yes, it's half of the market cap, but the other half is international. But we showed that this low vol effect is also present in Europe and Japan, which just makes it a very persistent anomaly. Other factors sometimes don't work in other regions, like momentum has difficulties in Japan. So that's one thing we wrote down there. The second thing is that we found that this anomaly, or this alpha, is getting stronger over time. So most alphas, once they're documented, they become a bit smaller. Like we've seen with value nowadays struggling for the past 10 years, much smaller than in the past 8 years. With low vol, it's a factor which is getting stronger over time. And thirdly, in our paper, we also gave explanations for why this might be the case. So why could it be that low risk beats high risk stocks? Now, you ask about how do we do this. So a simple way to test factors is to take, say, 2,000 large cap stocks, or the 2,000 largest stocks in the universe. You sort them based on their historical price movement. So you sort them from low volatility to high volatility. You can also sort them from low beta to high beta. And then you dynamically construct a portfolio where you systematically buy the stocks which have the lowest. And then a quarter later, you do it again, because some stocks might move from low risk to high risk, or then they might move a decent. So if you do that, then you construct portfolios which have stable, very stable risk properties. And then you're just going to test if this low risk portfolio has also a low risk, a low return, because that's what the CAPM, as we discussed, predicts. And the fact is totally the world upside down. It's the other way around. It's negative. If you add the compounding to it, so the longer your investment horizon, the bigger the alpha becomes. That's also what we lay down in the article. And the interesting thing is that of all the factors out there, the low vol factors have been driven by practitioners. So I'm a pracademic, so I'm a practitioner with also academic ties. So, but also Robert Hogan was not a main academic, so he was not part of the opinion makers on the big US universities. he was sort of an outcast. And also, if you read his books, it's very funny. He's really critical of the Chicago school. He makes fun of them. So I also understand why he was not loved by his peers in academia. But this low hole factor is something different than the others. It's a different factor, and nowadays it's more accepted. Also, the work of Eng has contributed to this, and also some researchers like Fazzini and Pedersen have also brought this anomaly more to the mainstream academia. And nowadays it's more or less accepted. The interesting thing is that practitioners have sort of led it. And also, if you look at asset managers, I'm based in the Netherlands, a beautiful country. All listeners should come there. But it's also driven by European managers. While most of the innovation in finance driven by Wall Street or the U.S., while this is a little bit more of a European phenomenon and also led by practitioners.
What are some of the explanations? So you think about low vol. I mean, you would think intuitively that most people would love low volatility stocks, you know, given the alternative with the research showing that they outperform. You've mentioned some possible explanations for the success of the strategy and or why it's inefficient, everything from leverage restrictions to inefficient industry practice, behavioral biases. What sort of specific reasons, you know, we always love to say, why does this work? What are the major contributing factors in your mind?
Yeah, so I spent 4 years of my life in my PhD on downside risk. So my thesis was, could these all these factors, so value, momentum, but also low risk, could it be explained by downside risk? So could it be tail beta? Could it be because the Kaplan also assumes mean variance returns or quadratic utility? I worked on that model, very complicated, technical. Long story, 4 years. Short story, not really. But tail risk is not really the explanation. You can partly explain some of the low volume, some of momentum, and some of small cap. I entered the industry. I came to Robeco, the firm I'm still working with. I met head of research. I said I found him working on multi-factor models. So that was in 2005. We did it multi-billion. We knew the work of Robert Horgan. He explains you should buy stocks with good profitability, good value, good momentum, and build factors around that. I was surprised to find out when I entered the industry that low risk, low vol was not exploited. And I spoke with our head of research, I still remember it, and I said, hey, David, why aren't we adding low risk as a factor for low vol? And then his answer was very simple. He said, Tim, you get equity-like returns, maybe a bit better, but you get lots of tracking error. And I said, pardon me, what are you saying about errors? What kind of error? And then he explained this concept of benchmark deviation, which is more an agnostic term. Tracking error. Tracking error is an industry concept. It's very elegant, and I understand why you should use it, but it's turning the concept of risk upside down. Low vol stocks have huge tracking errors. If markets go up, they lag. If markets go down, they do better. That's called tracking error. So if you put it in a multi-factor model, where the aim is to consistently outperform a benchmark, so each year after year after year beating the index, then low vol sucks, basically. It's a weak factor. And then I started to understand, like, hey, this is interesting. There are limits to arbitrage, benchmarks, leverage constraints. And then it got me going. I'm a bit of a contrarian guy. I thought if it's difficult to harvest for us, it's probably difficult for others as well. And we built a strategy around it. We called it conservative equity. And that was 12 years ago. And ever since, I've been working on this fascinating topic. And I still, until today, when you meet clients, prospects, talk about concept, and each time the benchmark comes back. So that's really an explanation I didn't expect.
I think you've done a little too good of a job starting to educate people, because I feel like our world is becoming a little more knowledgeable about this concept, I would say, over the past cycle. And so because of that, you have some of the industry titans like Asnas and Arnott starting to weigh in on the last few years, this concept of particular factors and valuations and whether you can time factors. So in this quant death match, where do you stand in sort of that spectrum of, yes, it matters that factor valuations and therefore you can also time them, or there's times they work better than others, or on the flip side, maybe it's nearly impossible to time them, even though it you can see at times when they may be expensive or not. Where are you on the spectrum?
Yeah, it's a good one. So I really like fights. So cat fights are great, but also quant fights or quant debates. I enjoy them even every time they occur. So for example, on value of timing, factor timing, there's a debate whether valuations matter. My standpoint is this. I think if you look at Rob Arnau, he stresses the fact that valuation matters. I agree with him on that. If you look at low volatility standalone, so you simply only look at low volatility and that's it, then you might enter up buying expensive defensive. And that's currently, for the last couple of years, that's the case. And our research shows, and his research, that that's, if you do that, then your expected return will be lower. So that's why I include valuation, we include valuation ever since 12 years ago, in our strategies. So we do multi-factor defensive. So we include valuation or net payout yield, which is also a valuation and quality metric. If you screen your low vol stocks on that, you can still find a cheapness. And you don't want to go against value. So if you look at the generic low vol strategy, so simply looking at a single factor low vol strategy, there is some timing in it. So if it's expensive, the returns are lower, cheap returns are high. But if you do a consistently cheap low-vol strategy, then this goes away. Timing is much more difficult, or after transaction cost, it's not possible anymore because you simply are always on the right side of value. You also mentioned Cliff Asmus, yeah, great guy, also a academic, builder, respect him. He also emphasizes momentum. So in his thesis, he works on that, and especially combining momentum with value. And I'm also agree on that one. So if you only do value, like you've seen with value the last 10 years, it's weak. The trend is your friend. Also, you wrote on trend following strategies map. It's a factor which works for hundreds of years. It also captures behavior. Academics also have problem grasping with momentum. So yes, you should also always include momentum in your strategy. So if you do a defensive strategy, make sure you do it multi-dimensional, multi-factor. So I also posted another paper on SFRM, and it's published in the Journal of Portfolio Management of this summer, where we say if you build a strategy based on low risk, income and momentum, so income is shareholder yield, that's also how it's referred to. If you do that, and we propose a simple formula, then basically you get access to all the factor premiums out there, all of them. So that's AQR factors, pump factors, Carhartt, and also the recently Luzon factors. And the reason I wrote that paper is that if you look in the whole academic literature for 50 years, basically if you look at Robert Horgan's work, you already know 90%. So not much happened after that, I would say. But still there's some new insight. The problem is, how do you translate all these academic insight into a simple strategy? And that's what we've tried to do in this recent paper. It's called Quantitative Investing Made Easy, the conserved formula. And there we say that the rule of three, so that's value momentum, yes, but also low risk, combining them gives you a very strong portfolio. So in the whole quant debate, I agree with the value guys, I agree with momentum guys, but I do see that low vol or low risk is sort of not getting the attention it should get, because it matters a lot, especially in the long run, if you add compounding to it. And also, if you look at the academic evidence, it's very persistent and strong, stronger than some of the others. And also, the final thing about why you should look at low vol is that the level of understanding, so why it's working, that's important for a factor, so you should know why it's working, otherwise it can be arbitraged away if it's irrational behavior. That the guys buying the high vol stocks are often very intelligent, highly educated guys, CFAs, PhDs, but just who have another incentive. And that makes it very interesting that this anomaly can be understood from a rational point of view, so not just behavior, but structural impediments.
Well, you're a man after my own heart talking about some of these factors. So we got low vol, Which by the way, what's a generic representation of low vol? As you mentioned, is it volatility over a certain time period? Is it volatility relative to a sector or market? What's a generic kind of factor expression of that?
Short answer, 3-year historical volatility, 156 weeks.
Okay.
Then you have something going.
Okay, perfect. And so in your book and in your paper, you mentioned some really simple multi-factor portfolios. So you talk about vol and then pairing it with payout yield, or shareholder yield, which is basically dividends and net buybacks, which is one of my favorite factors. So that gives you, like you mentioned, a little value and quality, and it has pretty high correlation to free cash flow, price free cash flow, and momentum. And so talk to me about sort of where that's finding opportunity around the world right now. Is it something that you do globally and, you know, you're finding the most opportunity in any regions or countries, or is it something that you're finding opportunity everywhere? There's nothing looks good. What would a screen like that look like today?
Yeah, we're international investors. So I'm based in Rotterdam. If I step on my bike, then I can be in Belgium in an hour. So we're international investors by default. So if I look at factors, I also look at them internationally. The interesting thing is that value has problems last time, but especially in the US. If you look at emerging markets, value is pretty good, also recently. But we do see lots of value in emerging markets. Also, we manage more than 20 billion in our strategies. A significant part of that, about 1/3, is in EM. So that's where we see lots of added value. Also there, the volatility is very high. These stocks are very volatile. So that's where we see value. And in the US, you see that the US market is quite expensive. So there you see that low vol and value are fighting. And when factors are fighting, that's often a tough period. And but we still find relatively cheap U.S. low vol stocks. But as you know, that tech has been driving the U.S. for the past 2 years. Any multi-factor strategy which gives way to value has some problems. And that's where momentum helps to keep up a bit and reduce the pain and the performance.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, we often say for multi-factor, our favorite combination is along the lines of my buddy Steve Sugarud says, cheap, hated, and in an uptrend. So kind of combining value and momentum. You mentioned earlier an interesting point, which was maybe momentum doesn't work necessarily in Japan, which is sort of odd. Is low vol a factor that seemingly works everywhere in the markets you've tested, or is there some where it actually doesn't work, or it tends to not work as well? Is there any broad takeaways?
Yeah, that's a good one. So low volatility works very good within all countries, all sectors. It's getting a bit stronger, so also over time. We do see that in earlier samples, like in the 40s and the 50s, it's a bit weaker. But still, it's producing risk-adjusted alpha. What you do see is that it's only not working across asset classes. So if you look at bonds versus equities, then you might say bonds are low risk and equities are high risk. But on that level, you don't see it working. So cross markets, there's not a local effect. Also cross currencies, it's more difficult. So I'm working currently on a 200-year study on factor investing. So you will love it when it comes out. Trend, of course, strong value, strong, but low risk. We see it to be across market a bit more difficult, and we understand it because the reasons for why low vol works is because of relative utility, benchmarking, leverage constraints. And on an asset class level, that's not really the case. You're making your asset allocation decision not on NV or tracking error, but just on your risk aversion. But then in the second step, then when you move into the equity market, then you start to be biased to high risk. So that's very fascinating. We also find it within credit markets. So we've done work on investment grade, high yield, also very strong there. And again, you see that within those two asset classes, it's strong, and across, it's a bit weaker. And you really see that it's important within asset classes. And yeah, Matt, maybe I know you love momentum and also CAPE you've been working on, but yeah, I would strongly suggest also to look at low volatility as a factor. because it makes the ride more smooth.
You just had a paper come out like a couple months ago that was kind of looking at low vol and CAPE, and you know, a lot of people we chat with are probably rightfully concerned about the U.S. market here domestically, about it being expensive, and what should they do? And it's your, depending on who you ask, your 10 bull market, but certainly coming off some really long period of strong returns. And you talk about in this paper how you examine low vol strategy might be a good defense against a expensive market. Could you unpack a little bit about what that paper talks about and some of your conclusions?
Yes. So CAPE is much talked indicator, Nobel Prize winning. The debate basically goes around the fact, does CAPE predict returns? And the answer is yes, especially in the longer term. There's lots of buts, there's lots of pros and cons to it. What we did in our study, we said we are not going to use CAPE to predict returns. We believe that with high CAPE, expected return is a bit lower. However, we said, let's turn it around. Let's use CAPE and then predict risk. But do not look at return of risk. And what you then see happening is that if CAPE is above 30, like today, then downside risk of equities is really big. So the predicted value of CAPE on risk is very high. And by putting these two together, so CAPE and not relating it to return, because people might say, yeah, return is a bit lower, but who cares? Going so low. But if you really show, and that's what we do in the paper, that high CAPE gives you a high expected downside risk, then you see a real danger of high valuations. So that's why I believe in value strategy, because then you can reduce it. What we do in the paper is that we then show, of course, how is low vol doing in such a scenario. And then you see that low vol stocks do what they should do, namely prevent risk and reduce risk, especially in a high CAPE scenario. But the point is, with low risk, is people either, if people are afraid of the market, they often try to time it, and they often do it in the wrong moment. So if CAPE is high, you might conclude, let's go out of the market. But then you will miss out the long-term equity. If you do a low vol strategy, then you can always be invested in the equity market and harvest equity returns without having to time the market. And then you can have both ways. So you can have your return, but you will also reduce your risk. And that's what we wrote down in our paper. And now we see it resonates very well with our clients all around the world who can use it for their outlook. Because many are fearful of high valuations, especially in the U.S., but then, yeah, it's too much to go out, and then defensive play might be a good alternative.
Interesting. So if there's an investor listening to this, obviously they could just go allocate some Robeco funds. But let's say they said, hey, I'm going to do this on my own, or I want to implement. Any general considerations to investors as to the best way to implement such a strategy or to think about it in the context of a portfolio?
Yeah, good one. So I also wrote a book on low-risk investing, and there I describe the story of my life about low risk and how it can be done, and especially focus on the implementation, as your question implies. So we say there can be three ways to do it. So either is do it yourself, and then a great way to do it is screen your universe. If you have a broker account, you can simply sort your stocks on beta and then throw out all the high beta stocks, and then you screen on a dividend or a shareholder yield. Then you throw out all the low yielders, and then finally you screen on momentum, and then you only pick the ones who do well. Then you can end up with a portfolio of about 100 stocks, and then you can do it yourself. Rebalance each quarter and make sure you don't trade too much. So that's for the guys who really have some money, who can diversify across 100 stocks, who like it. But they should be aware of the details, because only 100 stocks, it needs some time to nurture your portfolio. That's step one. That's one way to do it. Just do it yourself. And in the book, we provide easy ways to do it. And also, if you read my paper, on which is free on SSRN, there are enough ways to see how you can do it. The second is to buy an ETF. There are trackers of local indices around, many of them also in the U.S., then you buy simply track a low vol index. Then the problem is that you don't include value momentum, like we both believe in that, so you should also look at us. And then you can, the third way we present is it's by active funds, active local funds, which have a multi-factor approach, which do include value momentum. And one of those capabilities I'm managing myself as a fund manager. So that's full disclosure. But we want to say that there are multiple ways to get exposure to this great premium. This low volatility effect will benefit your long-term wealth. And yeah, your show also says it's about preserving your capital. I think that's very important in investing and often overlooks that risk. People often focus on return, but risk is really an important factor.
So you mentioned, and by the way, your book, High Returns from Low Risk, we'll post a link in the show notes. Great book, fun, easy read. You know, and a lot of factors, intentionally or not, can potentially give you bias towards certain things, neither necessarily good nor bad. I mean, we often talk about if you're a global investor, whether you do top down or bottom up, you end up in certain countries just because certain countries have 3,000 stocks and some only have probably 100. Are there any sectors that a low vol approach traditionally will bias you to? So I imagine a listener may be listening and say, well, am I just going to end up with a bunch of utility stocks with 80% of my portfolio and never own any Amazon? Is there any sort of tilts that this strategy ends up with? If so, is it good? Is it bad? Are there ways to correct it? All your thoughts on that.
Yeah, first of all, you do get tilts, like with any factor, and you do get tilts to more defensive sectors. Currently, that's telco utilities. However, telco was not always defensive, so that's time varying. If you do a multi-factor approach, these tilts get less. And so if you do pure low vol, nothing else, you get more pronounced sector effect and also country effect. These can be mitigated with a multi-factor approach, and they can further be mitigated with sector constraints. So you could say, hey, I want a maximum of 10% in one of the sector compared to an index, then you can manage this. However, it's not, if you look at the simulations, these fields are not really bad. So they help your performance because it also works as a factor to time and to select sectors. However, you do get some quite big benchmark deviations, and those can be managed. That depends on your risk tolerance. But we have very mild sector constraints, and we have this multi-factor approach. Both of them help get a very broadly diversified portfolio.
I wonder what your response would be. You know, certain people out there like Buffett, you know, would say, look, you know, they don't necessarily equate risk with volatility, but rather the permanent loss of capital. And I imagine some critics listening would say, hey, okay, low vol sounds great, but, you know, value sounded great going into 08, and some of the value managers got taken out to the woodshed because they followed value all the way down and lost 80% drawdown during the bear market. Do you think that in terms of drawdowns and permanent risk of loss, what's the biggest savior or benefit of low vol? Is it pairing it with value, or is it pairing it with momentum? Or is there certain unique attributes that help protect low vol in general to the kind of dual threat of large drawdowns and permanent loss of capital?
Generals tend to fight a cost war. So when the French were preparing for a Nazi Germany, they were basically repeating World War I in their simulations. And then the Germans came out with a blitzkrieg and did it differently. And then they crashed to the French. With investing, I often see the same. So back in 06, when we started our low vol strategy, I met many, many people who said, yeah, Tim, low vol is just value in disguise. Because back then, value was low risk and low risk was value. So they said, Tim, low vol is nothing new. It's old wine. Old bottle. I have my value management style, and I'm fine. So they basically were looking at 01 and 2000 with the burst of the tech bubble. And they thought they were prepared for the next crisis. They were not. Nowadays, many people I see, and back then, local was cheap, so that was good. Back then, after the crisis, of course, people knew that value didn't offer protection, local did, so many people said, hey, that's great. It's different. Then low vol became expensive. And then sometimes the same people said, hey, Pim, low vol is expensive. I don't like low vol. But then I said, hey, listen, at least you know it's not value. You see, it's a different factor. So first they don't like it because it's value, and then they don't like it because it's not value. So there's always a reason not to like it. That's interesting. The second thing is that nowadays, many people who are preparing for the next crash might think that low vol is offering them protection, because back in the way, it did. I'm pretty sure it will offer protection. However, I'm not 100% sure. So that's why I think in a new crisis, it could be that value will offer protection again. So why would you bet on one factor? Why would you bet only on low vol if you can also include value? So that's what I believe in, that to be prepared for the next crisis. It will not be 08, it will not be 00, but if you look at all the crises of the past 100, 200 years, a mix of momentum, value, and low risk is the best, because I'm fully agree that fast volatility is not the same as risk. Of course not. The thing is, risk is probability of loss and the amount of loss. That's what you want to predict. The thing is that historical volatility is pretty good at that. It's pretty, pretty good. If you add some other stuff like credit spreads from the credit market, but also momentum helps a bit. And if you add correlations, then you can build a model that really predicts downside risk, because that's in the end what matters. And volatility for me is just a way to predict it. And it's a very efficient way. And it's even better than using downside volatility. Many people think downside volatility could be better to use. But the thing is that if you use downside volatility as a predictor of future downside risk, then you throw away lots of information, because also what goes up often can go down quickly. So that's my standpoints. To predict downside risk, don't look at the past war, but look at all the wars and think about your tactics. And don't bet on one factor. And use all of them, at least the best of them.
All right. Well said. We've chatted majority of this podcast on low vol and multi-factors. You've written a boatload of papers and publications and ideas and teaching. What else is on your brain these days? Anything in particular you're working on, or any papers that you think are particularly interesting that don't get as much interest? You know, it's always funny where we'll write a paper or spend many days on a blog post or something, and we think it's the most profound thing in the world, and the world is just crickets and no one's interested. So is there anything out there that either you're excited about, or that you think deserves a little more discussion?
Yeah, a couple of things. First, I'm very happy with the p-hacking debate now going in academia.
Explain to what the audience what that means.
So the problem with academic research, not only in finance, but also in medical research, is that researchers have an incentive to publish positive results. So that means you do 20 tests, and then one out of 20 is significant. If you are a PhD or you're writing a paper, you do 20 tests, one of them is significant, and then you write a paper about it. But it's not. It's just fluke. It's nothing. It's noise. And you can always come up with a story which fits the data. So that's called in finance factor phishing. In social science, it's called p-hacking. It's data mining. It's wrong, because it gives us fake factors. And that's a serious issue. And ever since I switched from academia to being a practitioner, I found this to be the case. Then we found some great factors in the academic journals. Then we tested them on our own data, and then many were we could throw away. And then I was also shocked to see that the results, which were not true, were not falsified. Only knew it if you knew it, but it was not published. And nowadays that's switching in academia, and I'm happy with that. So there's it's going to be cleaned, and all the big editors of the big journals now at least admit that this is a problem. And they want to do something about it, which means several things. One is to accept more papers who address p-hacking, so we try to falsify all the results. Second is where you first pose an idea and then do the test. That's in finance a bit less possible, but especially outside finance, very relevant, that your work will be published no matter what comes out. Now, I'm fascinated by this, and I'm also working on factor investing on a 200-year perspective, for example. I like history. I love it. I love to read about it because we can certainly learn so much about history. So that's a couple of things which come together. So that's a project I'm on. And I also am fascinated by taking factor investing outside equities, into bonds and into allocation. And at my firm, I'm also doing some very exciting stuff there, building solutions outside equities. And there's huge demand for this. And it's disruptive for hedge funds, because you can simply do what hedge funds are doing, but then not for 220, but at a much more attractive fee based on solid academic research. Outside equities.
I'm looking forward to you posting your next paper on low vol investing applied to the cryptocurrency markets.
Yeah, that's where I spend hardly any time on that. So I'm a contrarian. So I just let everybody tweet and talk about it. I just leave it. For me, my favorite crypto is gold.
I don't think you can even claim low vol even exists in crypto I was looking at some of them today were up and down 15% in a single day. I don't even know if you can claim low vol exists. And so you mentioned before too, low vol, this works across assets as well. If you're looking at sort of a cross asset allocation sort of concept, I know you've written on some of those ideas as well. Is that something, you know, how do you think about comparing assets? So if you got equities and bonds and commodities, and some are just naturally higher vol in crypto, which is extreme vol. How do you think about that and putting it kind of all together in a portfolio? Is it such that you need to adjust them and say, well, look, sovereign bonds are naturally lower vol? So this kind of gets into the whole concept of course, risk parity and everything else. But what are your thoughts on putting the bowl soup together and putting together kind of an entire portfolio? Does low vol have a place there too or no?
Yeah, you can do it implicitly. So if you create a multi-asset portfolio, what you can do is put in local stocks, local bonds, and then you get a portfolio which has a lower vol, and then you can beautifully lever up. And that's also what Fisher Black recommended. So you can lever up your risky parts, and then so you build a 60-40 portfolio with a 40-60 risk profile, for example. That's how you can do it. If you do across markets, so that's where the evidence is mixed. That's what I said. So low vol works within assets very strongly. So within equities, within credits, especially when there's leverage and benchmarks. For example, for crypto, there's not so much leverage constraint because they're all very volatile. And there's also not a benchmark. So my prior would be that I would expect there might be a low vol effect, that people go for the most risky crypto. But I expect not the strongest results there. If you look across markets, also, it's less strong. So also within commodities, you see a weaker low-vol effect. So it's particularly strong within, and then you can use it, as you said, in a risk parity approach, where you, if you give equal weight to the different asset classes, then you often see that your risk return profile goes up. But then you go, then it ties into that. And that's, risk parity is not a very high breadth decision. That's common with cross market decisions. So it's just, for example, with risk parity, you often give more weight to bonds. And that's sort of a binary thing. If yields go up or down, that will drive your return. I'm a bit cautious on the multi-asset side with applying low vol, but you can really apply it strongly within asset class.
So we've kind of been chatting a lot about the past. Let's shift our gaze to the future. You know, you mentioned one, the pressure on fees, which I think is pretty universal, but still pretty early days considering the average median fees around the world, but hedge funds being kind of the most egregious example at 2 and 20. What are some other trends that you kind of look at our profession in the next 10, 20 years? You also mentioned the p-hacking and falsifying. I can't tell you how many pitches I get that it takes about 5 seconds to look at and say, okay, well, that's not even possible. This sharp ratio of 3 and no down years the past 20 years, yada, yada. What are some other trends you see developing, either well-known or not, or kind of any, this is hard for a quant to quant, but any forecasts you have about kind of the future of our world and research and everything else?
Yeah, first, I think passive has a long way to go still, so it can grow further and further and further. So in the US, it's more progressed, but still there, lots of room for growth. It can move beyond 50%. So that's one. And why is that? Because it's based on very solid reasoning. We trade too much and we pay too much for active management. So that's the truth mathematically, and it's going to swipe away lots of our business. So that's disrupting. Then there's always room for fundamental stock pickers, but it will be less so than it was in the past, but there will always be room. Two reasons. First, to set prices, price discovery. And second, is that people are always overconfident and that they think they will have skill to select the right manager, and many people are overconfident that they can select the right stocks. But there will always be room for that, but it will be smaller. And then in the middle between these two trends, there is systematic investing, quant or beta, in different many ways. I think that's where growth will be. And the problem there is, as you mentioned, there's also lots of, there are low barriers of entry. If you have a smart guy from Ukraine with a PhD in physics, and you have a Bloomberg backtest, you can just pitch your sharp two strategy. I think that's where in the future there will be some shakeout, but brand will also be important. So who is doing factor investing? Because there are so many factors out there, and there's this p-hacking, so you can pick the wrong ones, or you can do it in the wrong way. I think brands will come up where people would say these quant shops have a proven track record across multiple cycles. And that's what I will see going. And then another trend is that this factor investing, quant investing, will also move outside equities. It's now quite U.S. equity centric. So I expect it to move more to emerging markets. For example, we see much less plays there. And also to markets like the high yield bonds, investment grade bonds, and international equities, small caps, international. So that's if I look at the future. And I think that's good for consumers and clients. Fees, they will, if they pay a fee, they will get alpha for that. And that's good. And also when you look at factors, why they work, suppose markets become a bit more efficient because of this this movement, I also think it's beneficial to society because capital will be allocated in a better way and in a cheaper way. And that's for the real economy in the end, good news, I would say. So I'm pretty optimistic, Matt.
I like it. Yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, with this recent Fidelity news that they're launching zero fee index funds, this kind of barbell where the world's going to shift to market cap weighted indexes for essentially free. And then people that deliver alpha, or at least are attempting to, you know, can still charge a higher fee, but probably not 2 and 20. But it has to be something that just doesn't look like a closet index. Particularly here in the US, we have so many of these mutual funds that charge a fortune, and you essentially get the S&P 500, which is, I think people are starting to become wise to a little more as the days go on, but still don't know that it's a widely held belief. You have a lot of interaction with students. What's on their brain these days? Is there anything in the general conversations you're having that either makes you take a step back and get worried, or is it something that, you know, they all want to start mining companies for crypto in Iceland? What's kind of the general feedback there? Is it, or does everyone just kind of hate Wall Street and not interested and wants to go work for Amazon and Google? What's the general feedback there?
The interesting thing is that like banking is less attractive now than it was 10 years ago, for example, or when I studied. So what I do notice is that investing has become more a profession than it was in the 10, 20 years ago. So factor investing, if you Google it, there's so much information. So students are more knowledgeable. I do notice that they're not that wild, crazy cowboys. In fact, they're quite conservative in a way. So I do not get worried. When I speak with students, I get basically quite enthusiastic, quite down to earth, knowledgeable, very competitive. You do see that the international, lots of our students are international at our universities because I'm a Dutch native speaker, but our universities teach in English. Basically, most Dutch are bilingual. But then also international students come to our universities, and they put pressure. It's meritocracy here. It's really the best and the brightest one winning. So they're very focused on getting good results and either starting their own companies. That's more in vogue now than it was 20 years ago. So that's a difference. But yeah, very knowledgeable, very intelligent. And the level of knowledge of our profession has gone up, one's finance, which I teach. So quite interesting, and not that that worrying, more encouraging, I would say.
Yeah, I wonder if you're going to see that trend where investing in finance becomes almost more of like a boring profession where you have less and less of these major cowboy hedge funds of like the 70s and 80s, the Soroses and the Tigers, and you have, you know, the continued, I'd say just making it more professional, sort of buttoned down, kind of boring. I think that's probably a positive. I love the trend towards young people being interested in entrepreneurship and starting companies, all those ideas. I think that's, but these things go in cycles. You know, if you look at MBAs, any given year, what they're going into, it's a pretty oscillating trend over the years. Sometimes it's Wall Street, sometimes it's consulting, sometimes it's Silicon Valley and everything else. So interesting. Couple more questions. We got to wind it down. What's been your favorite surf destination you've been to? Is it, you got a local spot you can't tell anybody about in the Netherlands, or where? What's your favorite?
My favorite is the Canary Islands, I think, because there you can do both windsurfing, which I like, and the other parts. There's Costa Calma, where it's shallow, you can stand. So if you didn't do it for a year, it's okay. And on the other side, then you have the big waves. Not too big, because I'm not that good. But I'm just a fan. I love it. Be in the water and be washed away. Really feel the nature. So that's something I can recommend. And South Africa, that's such a beautiful country. Good surf there. But also,
too sharky.
Yes. Yeah, but... No risk, no return, eh?
Yeah, but good wine and everything else there.
Yeah, I've been there a couple of times. I love it because there's also Dutch heritage there. People speak Afrikaans, which is very close to the Dutch language. And also the drinking wine there. And, it's a beautiful, and it's the world in one country. It's third, second, and first world, just in one nation. And that's fascinating because we're all living in one world, only separated by borders. South Africa is basically a borderless country where you have the whole world in one country, and that gives challenges. And it's fascinating to see that. But also, nature is very, very good there, including the surf and some jobs.
I love it. I haven't been to either spot. As listeners know, I'm a fairly terrible surfer, so it'd be fun to get you and I on video, and they can watch the two quant Grom's highlight reel of bloopers, I imagine would be really funny. Last question we always ask the 2018 question is, looking back on your career, what's been your most memorable investment or trade? Good, bad, horrific, anything in between? Anything come to mind?
Yes. It's a trade I did when I was a teenager. I put first my saving amount in a mutual fund bond. I did investing with my dad, you know, great guy. I also mentioned in the book, Good Mentor. But I was a bit overconfident back then, and I wanted to do move into risk in the stock market. And I saw this great stock. It was airplane manufacturer, Dutch Pride, recently bought by the Germans. It was in tough times, very volatile, bad momentum, bad value. But back then, as a teenager, I didn't know about factor investing. I bought the stock, hoping it would rise up. And it did not. And it was a painful ride down. It taught me a lot. I lost most of my savings, two-thirds. I did not put all my savings in. But back then, it was a significant part of my net worth. And the why I like it is it taught me a lot. It was my college tuition fee for the real world of investing, because ever since Anytime I step into the behavioral biases, I know that this was just one example. And as a quant, I exploit human behavior, but I'm also very well aware of my own mistakes and my own biases, and that makes you humble. And so this is a great example. I lost money, but I think in the end, I made money out of it because it made me wiser and more experienced.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We talk a lot about this on the podcast, on how best to educate a young person about investing, and the challenge for so many is the best lesson almost when you're young is to lose money. And no one starts out with that as their goal, but certainly that's losses and you know, are the best teacher in the early days. I think the worst thing could probably happen is, you know, young people have many years of investing success only to build up a balance and then feel the pain when they have some more money. I don't know what the right answer is, but I think coming up with a curriculum there would be pretty fun and interesting.
What I can add to that is that's also why volatility works, I think, local. Because if you enter in a high vol stock or position, your learning curve is quicker. So Eric Falkenstein, another academic, also wrote books on low vol investing, writes about this element. That if you enter high vol assets, your learning curve is steeper. So it's also rational to do so. Like for me, it was rational to enter this high vol stock because it taught me a lot. It came at a price, but it also came at the return. And the return was not financial, but the return was I learned. And that's also interesting to note that this learning behavior, like you said, it should be taught at maybe to teenagers. Then I would maybe also use more volatile assets to give them a more quicker way to learn. So that's interesting where everything comes together.
I love it. All right, Pim, it's been a blast. Where can people find your writings? Where do they follow you? What's the best place to keep up with all your goings-ons?
Recently, I joined Twitter, so I'm on there, Paradox Investor. My paper's on SSREN. That's where you, if you Google me, Pim Van Vliet SSREN, you will see my papers, set alerts for new ones. And also on my company website, there's lots of stuff. Some of our white papers, like the one we discussed on CAPE, is also found there. So, and I'm active on LinkedIn. That's for so the network I'm using a lot.
Robeco is one of my favorite institutions as far as putting out quality investment content. So absolutely check that out. We will post show note links to all these things, white papers, books, links to your website, Twitter, all that good stuff. Pim, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it. And I just see myself on a good surf with you somewhere in Gran Canaria or South Africa. Look forward to that.
Perfect. I love it. Listeners, thanks for taking the time today to listen in. You can find show notes, everything else at mebfavor.com/podcast. Send us some questions for the feedback, radio shows, all that good stuff. Feedback@themebfavorshow.com. If you love the show, hate it, leave us a review and check out our new Best Investment Writing Book, Volume 2. Leave a review there as well. Thanks for listening, friends, and good investing.